All right, everyone, welcome to yet another Stoa Nova conversation with my friend Rob Coulter right there. Hi, Rob.
Hi, everybody. Glad everybody's here.
So today's topic is particularly germane to recent events because we're going to be talking about Stoicism and politics. But before we get there, let me remind you that the next episode of the Stoa Nova Conversations will actually take place in December, although right now I don't have the date.
it's the 15th.
The 15th, thank you. And
the 13th.
The 13th of December. Yep. And what is the topic, Rob? Because you set that one up.
The topic is a conversation with Eric Weiner, who is the author of a new book called The Socrates Express, in which he combines his love of travel with an exploration of historical philosophical schools, including, among others, Stoicism. And he has a whole chapter, interestingly, about attending Wyoming Stoic Camp, which he did a few years ago.
I noticed. And then he has one on Epictetus, and I think there's a third one on Stoicism. There's three on Stoicism.
He mentions Marcus quite a bit, too.
Yeah, that's right.
But he also explores Epicureanism and existentialism and Schopenhauer and a bunch of other things, too.
So I'm looking forward to it. Hopefully people will be interested. We'll try to focus that discussion mostly on Stoicism, but it's also nice to have a comparison between different kinds of schools, particularly ancient Greek ones. Now, back to today. So we are, this is November 15th. The election, presidential election in the United States is over, most people think. and we're not going to talk about that, or at least we're going to try to stay away as much as possible from that one. But we're going to try to address these questions and have a conversation. I don't know what Rob thinks about these whole things. So it's going to be interesting, actually, for the two of us to kind of unfold our thoughts as we go. That's what a conversation is supposed to be about, right? Yep. And so the question is, what is the relationship, if any, between Stoicism and politics? Now, I would suggest that there is, in fact, a connection there. Stoics do talk about politics and do act on, politically, but it's going to be interesting to see how the ancient ones actually did it and what does imply, if anything, for modern Stoicism. Before we get, just to get us started, because we already got started, I'd like to read a quote from Marcus Aurelius, Meditations 1:14. The first book of the Meditations, as probably many people here know, is essentially a long exercise in being thankful, right? It's Marcus just mentions a number of people that he learned from, and he says, thanks to my grandfather, I learned this, thanks to my mother, I learned that, et cetera, et cetera. Well, one of these, at section 14, is it was through my brother Severus that I came to know Thrasea, Helvidius, Cato, Dio, Brutus, and to conceive the idea of a balanced constitution and of government founded on equity and freedom of speech, and of a monarchy which values above all things, the freedom of the subject. Now, there are two reasons why this is a remarkable passage and why I chose it to introduce this discussion about Stoicism and politics. One is, this is the emperor, Marcus Aurelius, and he's talking about the desirability of a balanced constitution, government founded on equity and freedom of speech, and a ruler who values above all things the freedom of the subject. Forgive me for being surprised. this is not exactly something that was typical in ancient Rome or the ancient world. And frankly, unfortunately, it's not typical enough of today's world either. So this is a remarkable statement. But the part that I wanted to bring people's attention to is the first bit where Marcus mentions a number of names: Thrasea, Helvidius, Cato, Dio, Brutus. We'll probably talk about at least some of these later on in the show. But these are all Stoics, self-professed Stoics, either senators, generals, statesmen, philosophers, who at one point or another during the history of Roman Republic and the Roman Empire actually literally fought. They took up arms or otherwise vociferously complained, manifested against what they considered tyranny. So we clearly have an example of an emperor that is thinking in political terms, as you would think, given that he's emperor, and B, and in remarkably modern political terms, and B, a list of people, which is, it's a partial list of actual Stoics who have been involved actively in politics. So what does that make you think of, Rob?
Well, I think it's interesting. Sometimes I hear when discussing Stoicism in relation to politics or other things, that people want to emphasize something that politics is somehow an indifferent. And while I think there's a technical sense in which that's right, I think that we have to sort of face up to the fact that that doesn't mean we shouldn't care about the political world, right? You know, the list of characters Marcus mentioned and you emphasized there are, as you rightly point out, hugely impactful political characters in the Roman Republic. But I also think it's worth Roman Empire mostly, and although except for, well, Brutus is kind of a crossover figure there, of course. But the idea of Stoics being involved in politics goes back to the very beginnings of the Stoa, right? So one of the founding documents of the Stoa, maybe the founding document written by Zeno, is called the Republic.
Right.
And it falls into a tradition that goes back at least to Plato of doing political theorizing based on philosophical principles. And as is typical of that era, he's putting forth some idea of an ideal political society, the sort of society that would be best for human beings to live in. And unfortunately, we don't have much in the way of evidence for what he actually said there.
Nope.
Right? As far as direct evidence goes, I believe the closest thing to direct evidence we have is two lines in Diogenes Laertius.
Yeah.
And there's some secondary stuff and so on. But he emphasizes things like a community of sages and the centrality of love in our relationships and some other things that sound a little bit to me like a hippie commune.
That's right. One of the things that we do know he says in that book is that slavery is an evil.
That's right.
Interesting, which is important because the Stoics were actually apparently, not just based on that fragment, there are comments from slavery by later Stoics, including Seneca.
For sure.
But we do know that they consider that so the institution an evil, not just, you know, because Seneca talks about, you know, you should treat the person who you call a slave is a human being and you should treat it accordingly, which is important. It's not, but it doesn't actually address directly the institution of slavery itself. On the other hand, apparently Zeno did, based on the few fragments we have.
That's right. That's quite right. And another thing I think we can see, and I'm basing some of this on a remarkable study by Malcolm Schofield on Zeno's Republic called The Stoic Ideal of the City, is some idea of natural law,
yes.
which it seems to me based in the idea of cosmopolitanism, right? And I think that's, so whatever we want to say about Stoic political theory is, one, they were interested in it from the beginning of the Stoa, right? So it's not something that is like beyond what's appropriate for consideration as a Stoic. Even if certain things about outcomes of elections are in fact indifferent, nonetheless, we have an interest in doing that, in engaging in doing so. So we have to pay attention to that point and the cosmopolitanism that's related to that. And then I think another really important thing that you point out is that many of the most well-known Stoics in the Roman era were hugely involved politically, but that also goes back to the very beginning of the Stoa too.
Yeah.
Students of Zeno were involved in both the Macedonian Antigonid dynasty that followed Alexander as advisors to Antigonus, who was Alexander's successor, and also a well-known Stoic named Spyrus was an advisor to the kings of Sparta.
That's right. That's right. In fact, not to remind me, the Diogenes of Babylon, I think was his name, was still one of the early Stoics. He was involved in this famous diplomatic mission that Athens sent to Rome,
right.
Because Athens had unwisely started making, you know, noises with some of the Roman neighbors, and the Romans punished the Athenians with a fine, basically, with an ongoing fine. And so the Athenians sent three philosophers. Right there, that's kind of amazing, right? That's like three philosophers were sent by the Athenian state to negotiate with Rome. One of the interesting, and one of them was a Stoic, which tells you that these people were involved in politics at the highest levels. They were literally the representatives of their city-state. The interesting bit about that episode is that, and which happened at the time of Cato the Elder, the grandfather of Cato the Younger, about whom we'll talk about later. So we're in early Roman Republic, really, still kind of in terms of historical period. The interesting thing is that the three philosophers in question failed abysmally in their diplomatic mission. The Romans said, "No, sorry, this is the fine. You got to keep paying that one." But that was the first time that philosophers actually visited Rome. And these people, all three of them, gave public lectures that were wildly successful with the Roman youth, so much so that the ultra-conservative Cato the Elder was disgusted by this whole thing. And because these were people who were teaching the young Romans to argue one way or the other, you know, and be good at arguing, regardless, one of the philosophers in question was a sophist. But this is relevant because that actually is the first time we hear about philosophy in Rome.
That's right.
And that led eventually later to the very first truly entirely Roman philosopher of the Roman Republic, who was Cicero. So
no, that's quite right. And another really important influence, I think, of that embassy of the Athenian philosophers was its influence on Roman fashion in terms of the philosopher's beard.
That's right.
Was introduced into Rome and became rather popular among certain sects of Rome.
Yeah, that's right. By the way, speaking of beards, so we both sports beards at this point. And let's open up this little parenthesis. There is this little bit in Epictetus' discourses, where he talks about his beard as a philosopher. And the first time I read that bit, I thought, what the hell is he talking about? Because he's saying that the emperor is threatened him to cut off his head unless he shaved his beard. And Epictetus says, no, I am going to keep my beard even if you cut off my head. And I said, that seems a little too much in terms of, you know, like I understand that one likes his beard. But it turns out that sporting a beard, as you just said, was the hallmark of a philosopher.
That's right.
So it was the external representation of your identity. So what Epictetus there is saying is not that the beard per se is important. It's the identity. The emperor is trying to take away your identity. And Epictetus is basically saying, nope, sorry. You may kill me, but I am not going to give up who I am. For that reason, that emperor in question was Domitian. For that reason, Epictetus was actually sent into exile.
That's right. That's right. And which in some ways is a great consequence for us.
Absolutely. Right?
Because now we have all of Arrian's writings from Epictetus, which we might not have had otherwise.
Exactly. Now, I want to go back before we continue the discussion about politics, about this bit that you mentioned correctly about the indifference. I am still kind of surprised that not only people who don't know anything about Stoicism, which is, I guess, understandable, but even some Stoic practitioners themselves keep making this confusion about the indifference. And I understand that the English word particularly lends itself to this kind of misunderstanding, right? If I say, hey, politics should be indifferent to you, you say, oh, so that means that we shouldn't give a crap about it. Well, no, because as you pointed out, the word indifferent there is a technical term in Stoicism, and it just means morally indifferent. It means that the outcome of the elections, whether X or Z wins an election, doesn't affect me as a mortal being because it's an external, it's not my doing. The only thing that affect me as a mortal being are my doings. Who I vote for the election affects me as a mortal being because that's a moral decision that is up to me. But who wins the election doesn't in that particular sense. But that absolutely doesn't mean that we shouldn't care about externals. And so it's always something that is worth pointing out because particularly when it comes to things like politics, like, oh, well, shouldn't. In fact, I said we were not going to talk about the US presidential election, and we're not in terms of outcomes. But before the election, I tweeted a number of things that were pertinent, or articles that were pertinent to the run-up to the election. And several people tweeted back saying, but shouldn't the outcome of the election be indifferent for a Stoic? And I said, well, let me tell you what indifferent actually means. Right? So it's not indifferent in the sense that you don't care. It's only indifferent in the sense it doesn't affect you morally.
Yeah, let me take a stab at that idea, because I do think it is tricky, right? You know, the Greek term there is adiaphora, right? Mm-hmm. That which makes no difference.
Right.
Okay. But makes no difference to what? Well, it makes no difference to my well-being or my virtue, right? And this is what's really important, right? As we know, the Stoic view is the only thing that's good or bad is virtue and virtuous activity,
right?
Right? So the only thing that can matter is my virtue. And the outcome of an election or a military revolution or any other what we might call political outcome, whether we think it's legitimate or not, cannot make any difference to my virtue, right? The only thing that can make a difference to my virtue is my choices, right? My virtuous choices, that's it, right?
Yeah.
Now, what makes something preferred or dispreferred, and I'm not 100% sure that you and I are totally on the same page about this, but
all right,
think we're far apart.
Let's talk about it.
is the way I see it, right? What makes something a preferred indifferent as opposed to a dispreferred indifferent, as opposed to just a plain indifferent indifferent, is the following, right? So while an indifferent is not, it's external, I'm with you on that, right? It's something that cannot affect my virtue, right? Something that's indifferent, that is preferred, is one that tends to promote virtue or tends to create situations in which virtue is more likely, right? So again, I think that the idea between preferred and dispreferred indifference has to do with, still sort of derivatively related to virtue, right? So being preferred is not just like what I like, right? Right. And I think that's really important too. So I can have a preferred, I can think that a certain outcome is preferred in this sense, because I believe that that sort of outcome is better for the virtues of human beings, better for the promotion of the flourishing of a virtuous society, perhaps, right? So in that sense, I might think it's better or not. And that's clearly sort of a way of caring.
Right, about, exactly.
Right?
Exactly. Yeah, I don't think that we necessarily actually disagree with that. So my understanding, particularly from the way Diogenes Laertius describes the situation, is that in fact, as you just pointed out, the Stoics recognize only one true good, that's virtue, only one true bad, that's vice, your own virtue and your own vice, okay? And those are under your control. Everything else is external. Yep. And the externals are divided into preferred indifference, dispreferred indifference, and things that are completely neutral.
Yep.
Right? So whether, for instance, I prefer to watch a particular show on television or not, that's an entirely neutral thing.
Right.
Unless there are exceptions, unless for some reason this is such a good show, well written, that it's like it actually improves my makes me think morally, and so it improves my virtue. But other than that, let's take an even more clear example. My taste in gelato is entirely neutral; it's got nothing to do with virtue or vice. However, the rest, let's say, one of the things that people consider often preferred indifference is money, right? Wealth. There, I actually agree with your analysis, and I pointed out on several occasions that actually money by itself is not necessarily a preferred indifferent. It may be dispreferred. It depends on how it's used, right? So if money if somebody who is virtuous and who is a good person, etc., has wealth and he uses it, in order to better human beings, humanity at large, then yet definitely that is, wealth is a preferred indifferent. But the wealth of a tyrant is not a preferred indifferent. It's actually a dispreferred indifferent. I'd rather have a tyrant not being wealthy, because then he's going to be able to do less damage to society at large. So I think I agree with your take on it.
I think that's quite right. Yeah.
Now, you were saying earlier, you know, that we know a number of people, and I mentioned the quote from Marco Aurelius mentions a few. So I'd like to get actually a few more names out there that we might talk about a little bit. And by the way, I'm going to remind our viewers that, you know, live viewers, that we're going to open up for Q&A in a little bit. So if you have a comment or a question, short comment or a question, then you might want to raise your virtual hand, you know, in the next few minutes. So here's a short list, and it's certainly an incomplete list of people who are both Stoic and clearly involved politically. Gaius Blossius, mm-hmm. who during the early time of the Republic was an advisor to the tribune of the plebeians, Tiberius Gracchus. And he advised him on issues pertaining to land reform in the Roman Republic. Now, Tiberius was killed by a mob that was hired by the opposing political faction. And Gaius was actually put on trial for possibly being a traitor. He was acquitted, actually. He left Rome, and then he went down into the province of Asia, as the Romans grandly called it, but it was actually Western Turkey. And actually it helped another king to start a revolution, which failed against the Romans. So here's somebody who was a political advisor first, and then literally took up arms in response to what he saw as injustice. We've heard Marcus refer to Brutus. That would be Marcus Junius Brutus, who obviously was one of the major co-conspirators, in fact, the major co-conspirator against Julius Caesar. We've heard Cato, that was Cato the Younger, another person who was a senator and then took up arms against Julius Caesar because they both Brutus and Cato saw Caesar as a tyrant, as somebody who wanted to, you know, eliminate the Republic and crown himself king. Later on, we have the group that you referred earlier to as the Stoic opposition against three different Roman emperors, Nero, Vespasian, and Domitian. And this included a lot of people, arguably Seneca, at least indirectly, because it's true that Seneca did not, well, it appears to be true that Seneca did not take part in the famous Pisonian conspiracy that failed against Nero. But he was killed as a result, and probably for good reason, because Seneca probably knew about the conspiracy and didn't tell the emperor. That's pretty much the same as favoring the conspiracy. So, but whether you want to call, you know, want to count Seneca or not, certainly the following people are: Musonius Rufus, who was Epictetus' teacher. He was sent into exile multiple times. The first time he actually volunteered to accompany a friend. The second time he was sent by the emperor, and then the third time later on. Epictetus himself, who was sent into exile. Pomponius Agrippinus, sent into exile. Publius Claudius Thrasea Paetus, death penalty. Rubellius Plautus, exiled with, he was the one who was exiled in together with Musonius on the Greek island of Gyara, and then later on he was put to death. Elvidius Priscus, first exile, then death. Dio Chrysostom, exile. Arulenus Rusticus, death. Herennius Senecio, death. So this is quite a number of people. And we hear about these people in part from Epictetus himself. So there are two passages I'd like to read quickly, and then we'll resume our discussion. So one is from Discourses 1:1, 28-30. So what was it that Agrippinus used to say? And this would be one of the people that I just mentioned, right? Pomponius Agrippinus, who was sent into exile. I won't become an obstacle to myself. The news was brought to him that your case is being tried in the Senate. May everything go well. But the fifth hour has arrived. This was the hour in which he was in the habit of taking his exercise and then having a cold bath. So let's go off and take some exercise. When he had completed his exercise, someone came and told him, "You've been convicted." "To exile?" he asked, "or to death?" "To exile." "What about property?" "It hasn't been confiscated." "Then let's go away to Aricia and eat our meal there." This is a classic example, of course, of Stoic response to adversity, right? So the guy is being put on trial, and he said, "Well, right now I don't know the outcome of it, so let's go take some exercise in a bath, because that's what we do at this time." And once he knows that he's being convicted, he's like, "Well, death or Exactly. Fine. Then let's go to one of my villas. Arice is a beautiful location outside of Rome, where, you know, we can have our meal. So we have actually these stories directly in the discourses. Another one is at Discourses 1-2, 1921. This is about Helvidius Priscus, another one of the people that I mentioned earlier. When Vespasian sent for Helvidius Priscus and commanded him not to go into the Senate, he replied, "It is in your power not to allow me to be a member of the Senate, but so long as I am, I must go in." "Well, go in then," says the emperor, "but say nothing. Do not ask my opinion, and I will be silent. But I must ask your opinion, and I must say what I think right. But if you do, I shall put you to death. When then did I tell you that I am immortal? You will do your part, and I will do mine. It is your part to kill, it is mine to die, but not in fear. Yours to banish me, mine to depart with sorrow." Right. So this, if this is not political involvement, I don't know what counts. And in fact, apparently, this was also at a systemic level. And this is the last quote I'm going to read, then we'll resume the discussion. It's a systemic level, which is an important point to make, because often people, they hear about the Stoic opposition and say, well, but that, okay, fine, that those were individuals who were, you just happened to be Stoics, and they also were, you know, on a political, on a particular political side. That's not quite the case. And we know this, for example, from a letter that was written by Cossutianus Capito, who was one of Nero's advisors. And he wrote a letter in which he said, "Either let us pass over to his creed," we're talking about, they're talking about Stoicism, "if it is the better, or let these seekers after a new world lose their chief and their instigator. It is the sect that subverts the empire. They make a parade of liberty, the empire overthrown. They will lay hands on liberty itself. You have removed Cassius to little purpose if you intend to allow these rivals of the Bruti to multiply and flourish." So this is a direct accusation of systemic political involvement by the Stoics. Like, you know, if you let these people run the place, you're gonna be out of here. And so you shouldn't go just after one of them. You should just go under the entire sect, so to speak. Right?
Yeah.
So it really doesn't get any clearer than this, I think.
I think that's right. I mean, but of course, what we see is sort of one sort of manifestation of it in one sort of particular context, that of, I mean, well, we see a couple of them, but in Rome, right? You know, there's the resistance to Caesar of Brutus and Cato, and then there's the opposition to Nero and the others. But in both cases, we see the Stoics standing on the side of what they would say is liberty and opposition to tyranny, right? In both cases. One of the things that I always notice about the Helvidius Priscus and the Agrippinus passages in Discourses is not only are they evidence of the involvement of these Stoic figures, but they also offer models of how to be involved, which I think is really valuable, right? They're going to do their duty, right? So we don't see Helvidius Priscus, for example, there when he's trying to go into the Senate or whatever. He's not frothing at the mouth, you know, stamping up and down about his rights or even his duties, right? And what we see, though, is someone who's calmly setting about to do his duty, recognizing that he could be thwarted in that duty, right? Nonetheless, he still needs to do the duty, whatever it is. And I think that's really an interesting model that we also see in the cases of, Agrippinus, Cato, for example. Cato, who thought it was his duty to disembowel himself, right? Which he went about apparently as calmly as one can do such a thing, I suppose. Yeah. So not only do we get a picture of how they acted, that they acted, but the way they comport themselves in acting, which I think is really also valuable.
That's right. I want to make a point about, since you brought up Cato. So sometimes I have conversations about Stoicism and politics, and people point out, I think fairly correctly, that a lot of the Stoics that we know of politically, and those are, in fact, as you pointed out, the Roman ones, they tended to be at the time what we would not today consider conservatives, right? So just to give some background, you know, politically conservative. So the first thing, of course, first caveat there is that, well, maybe, but actually conservatism in ancient Rome isn't got not much to do with conservatism in modern, you know, like American or European politics. But even so, I mean, there is a point to that observation. It is true, just as a background, for instance, that throughout the Roman Empire, the Roman Republic, sorry, in the early Empire, there were these two parties, the optimates, which literally means the best people, right? And then the populares, which literally means the people of the people. And the Tiberius Gracchus that I mentioned was a member of the Populares party. You know, he was a tribune of the plebeians, and he was trying to do these, to push through this land reform. Land reform, or I should say lack of land reform, is what probably killed the Roman Republic, okay? Because the Senate could not agree on how to redistribute land to small landowners, mostly ex-soldiers that were coming back from the Roman campaigns, or more, you know, less well-to-do people. And the reason they couldn't agree, of course, is because most of the members in the Senate were large owners of large tracts of land, and they were making a lot of money out of it. So obviously they couldn't agree, right? But even within the Senate, there were these two parties. And Julius Caesar, for instance, considered himself a member of the Populares party, right? Mm-hmm. And he was fighting for land reform. Cato, on the other hand, and Brutus were on the optimates side, which today you would say, okay, so that's the side of the billionaires or the millionaire, the 1%, and, you know, that, things like that. And fine, that's okay. The point here is not that individual Stoics in their time necessarily saw clearly what was the thing to fight for, or what was the right political ideas to get behind. None of those people were sages. So we're not talking about the specifics of their ideas. They may have been wrong, or they may have been right, or they may be more likely partially right and partially wrong. In the case of Cato, for instance, I think he was in fact blind to the problem of land reform. Land reform, you know, even Cicero, who was a member of the optimates, did see the problem. And he tried, you know, Cicero often has this, is characterized as this kind of wishy-washy individual that goes one side and then the other, and then one side and then the other. But in fact, if you read one of his the recent biographies of Cicero, he was actually remarkably consistent. His first and objective was to save the Republic. And he realized as a politician that, as a diplomat, that in order to do that, he had to shift allegiances depending on what the situation was and how it was developing. So, but even Cicero realized that the lack of land reform was a problem, was the thing that was determining the crisis. So Cato was blind in that sense, but Cato was right in seeing Caesar as a tyrant. You know, Caesar did die, but his adopted son Octavian then became the first emperor. So he was definitely right. So the discussion that we're having here is not necessarily about, is this particular position, political position, correct or not? Because we today have the same problem, right? I mean, I have my own, obviously, preferences in terms of politics, but I'm pretty sure that 10 years or 20 years or 50 years down the road, some of my positions that I'm pretty confident about will be shown to be, you know, debatable at the very least, and possibly even wrong. So, and that's because we're not sages, right? We're not infallible in our judgment.
That's quite right. But, and one of the things I think we look to when judging those of the past, like Cato, or take your pick of any of these guys we're talking about, is we want to take our best understanding of the principles that undergird the philosophical position towards life that we take and apply those to life as it presents itself to us, right? We can look back and see, for example, like you just said about Cato, he seemed to kind of get it here on this point and maybe not so much on this point. And we might say the same thing about Sarsea, especially if we knew a lot more about what he said. We could also say the same thing about Seneca, right? Seneca is a controversial figure here, right? Yep. Because of his relationship with Nero. And, right, I mean, there's Marcus and Epictetus seem to have a pretty clear position on Seneca, right? They don't even mention his name.
That's right.
Right? Now, we might say that's right or wrong, too, looking back, right? Because we want to But we want to apply the same sort of judgments to these figures of the past as we do to ourselves, and the same sort of fallibility.
Exactly.
Right? Exactly. I mean, this is something, this fallibility thing is something that occurs over and over again in these thinkers, Epictetus and Marcus, especially in Marcus, right? I mean, he talks about, right, all these people that he thinks are terribly wrong about this, that, or the other thing. They're advocating what seems best to them.
Exactly. Right? Exactly.
Right? And that's so important, I think, as a Stoic involved in the world of the political world, which is the world we all live in, right, is to recognize some of these, again, basic Stoic principles that involve both sort of some compassion for the fallibility, not only of our people we see as our opponents, maybe, but also for ourselves.
Yes, exactly. I try very consciously, and you know, sometimes, of course, I slip up, but I try very consciously to apply this to my discussions on both online and with my friends. I have some friends who are of different political persuasions than my own, right? But I try to remember, you know, these are not actually my enemies. These are people who have arrived at different kinds of judgments. I think they're wrong. They think that I'm wrong, of course, on the specifics. It could be either way. It could turn out one way or the other. It also depends on what our assumptions are, you know, background assumptions are about society and how it should be run, et cetera, et cetera. So the kinds of people that I tend to criticize the most in the political arena are people who I think actually lack integrity. So these are not people with whom I happen to disagree about this issue or that issue, because I think that's fine. These are people who I think lack integrity, who lie their way through things, who clearly espouse positions that are, you know, awful, like, you know, openly and unabashedly, you know, I don't know, racist or misogynist or something like that. But those are actually those are a relative minority, and even those people think that what they're doing is right. Right, that they have good reasons for that. Now, you mentioned Seneca, of course, and we do have a question in the chat from Xinxi. She says, didn't Seneca advocate retreat from public life in his letters? And yes, he did. That's one in one of the letters to Lucilius. However, he did not advocate. First of all, Seneca was retired, in fact, at that time, or in fact, was trying to retire. Nero wasn't really agreeing on with that project. And so Seneca wrote the letters to Lucilius when he was actually fairly old. He was, you know, in his late 60s already. It was like 2 or 3 years before he died. So he was in retirement age at that point. But also, he doesn't advocate that as a retreat from politics, because he actually says in the very same letters, like, you know, there are different ways to serve the state and to serve, you know, virtue. Certainly one is to be involved as a politician or as an advisor, et cetera, which is what he did early on in his career. But, you know, you can also influence people. You can also do your duty in a smaller setting. And that still contributes to the cosmopolis. That still contributes to the welfare and virtue of the state. So yes, it did advocate retirement, but it was in a very, you know, limited context, essentially, that we're talking about. So you mentioned cosmopolitanism earlier, and then we kind of got diverted into other discussions. Why did you bring that up?
Well, cosmopolitanism, right, is basically the idea that we are all citizens of one and the same cosmos. And then so the whole of the universe is a cosmos, an arrangement, a structure that each of us lives in and shares in and has a part to play in. Right. And insofar as we're all citizens of this cosmos, and that's all cosmopolitan means, is a citizen of the cosmos. Right. We have a certain sort of equality of moral value. Right. And recognizing this, I think, puts some picture or puts some weight on what a Stoic might be sort of committed to, right? Some sort of idea that of the equality of all, right? Which is brought out, of course, in that passage that you brought up from book one of the Meditations, right? Of government founded on equity and freedom of speech, and of a monarchy which values above all things the freedom of the subject. Now, it's not exactly It's not exactly the sort of thing we find in, say, I don't know, the American Declaration of Independence or
right.
something like that. But it does seem to advocate equity among all citizens of the cosmos, right? So that seems to suggest something along the lines of a universality that maybe some of their rival schools at the time would not have been so accepting of. Certainly Aristotle's views, for example, would not resonate with a Stoic at that time.
Right. I actually read an interesting article by John Sellers, was published a few years ago, about cosmopolitanism, Stoic and Cynic cosmopolitanism. And he made an interesting distinction actually between the Cynic and the Stoic cosmopolitanism on the basis of, again, as you were saying, Ella, the few fragments that we actually have and mostly later sources. And his point, if I remember correctly, was that the Cynics were cosmopolitan in a very abstract sense. It was actually not a political project of any kind. In fact, cynism itself was not a political project. You couldn't imagine turning society into a bunch of cynics.
It's more of an anti-political
project. Right, exactly. It's an anti-political project. Because, you know, if we turn everybody into cynics, then, you know, the cynics were literally beggars. And, you know, if everybody's a beggar, there's nobody to beg from, among other things. And Epictetus himself calls cynicism a calling, right? It's something that you do only if you're a special kind of person. So it couldn't possibly be a political project. However, Sellers argues that the Stoics, on the other hand, sort of started making the change toward a conceiving, because of Zeno's Republic, starting conceiving of that as an actual possibility, as something that might at some point actually happen, that you want to improve society and going in a certain direction. But interestingly, Sellers makes the observation that the person that really tried to concretely sort of move toward an actual political process based on largely on Stoic ideas was Cicero. And the reason for that is that Cicero was highly influenced by the Stoics. He was not a Stoic, as we know. He was an academic skeptic, but if he belonged to any particular school, but he was highly influenced by the Stoics. He saw the Stoics' ethics as really compelling. But he was also a politician. He was practical. He was, you know, he had been a consul in Rome. He had been in charge of things in Rome. He had seen political crises play out, and he had participated into the political process. And so he was the one that actually tried to put things into more pragmatic terms. And the way he tried to do that was through something that you mentioned early on, which is natural law. Mm-hmm. Right. So a concept of natural law, and we tend to think today of natural law as mostly a Christian thing, so this notion, which essentially means divine law in the case of the Christians, right? So that there is an absolute right and wrong, and that is established by, you know, the creator God. But in fact, although certainly the medieval Christians, Thomas Aquinas particularly, did subscribe to the notion of natural law, the notion itself originates earlier in a pre-Christian fashion, and it doesn't have anything to do with gods. It has to do with the fact that there are some things that are naturally right or naturally wrong, given the nature of humanity. Given it is what today Philippa Foot calls naturalistic ethics, right? In her book Natural Goodness, that's what she argues. That there are some things that are, she actually argues against the sort of essentially rampant relativism of much modern moral philosophers. And she says, no, there are some things that are, in fact, naturally good or not good for human beings, like in the same way in which there are things that are naturally good or not good for a plant, for a lion, for any other kind of organism, right? And now, it remains an interesting and open project to see just how much specifics you can get out of that general idea, of course. But that project was, in fact, essentially started by Cicero, and it was an eminently political process.
Yeah, I think that's I think that's quite plausible. Cicero bringing the logos to the forum, right?
Yes, exactly.
Right, and the idea of natural law we can clearly see as early as Heraclitus, I think, but again, not well worked out. It doesn't tell us what that means. It doesn't tell what the natural laws are, right? But that's the notion of the logos and all of that that lurks in the background here too.
Yeah. We have a comment in the chat from Abdul. Benjamin Franklin is supposed to have said the Republic would flourish if freedoms be combined with wisdom and virtue. Isn't that a bit of a Stoic influence? And is there anything else in the U.S. Constitution where that influence shows up? Well, I'm not sure about the U.S. Constitution, but it certainly is the case that Benjamin Franklin in particular, but also other founding fathers, including George Washington and Thomas Jefferson, were influenced by the Stoics. That doesn't mean they were Stoics or that they considered themselves Stoics. In fact, Jefferson explicitly says that he considered himself an Epicurean. But all three of the people that I mentioned actually had personal copies of Epictetus and Charidion. And Washington was a particularly interesting character because not only he was influenced by Epictetus, but he actually read, there's an episode that was very interesting during one of the turning points in the American Civil War when the Americans were actually kind of beat by the British. Washington gave a speech to his troops. And the speech was had large sections lifted from a British play, which, by the way, was illegal at the time. He shouldn't have done it because by law, because the Americans were not supposed by law to use anything that was published in Britain. But he lifted these passages from a British play, that was about Cato the Younger. And he used Cato as a role model. So I think that certainly are influences as recent as, the American Revolution and possibly later from a political perspective. The Cato, probably people have heard of the Cato Institute, which is a libertarian think tank. Well, the Cato Institute is named after Cato the Younger. And the connection is not direct, because it's indirect in this sense that during the, I believe it was the 18th century, early 18th century, there were a number of anonymous pamphlets published in Britain about freedom from government and limited government and so on and so forth, freedom from tyranny. And they were signed Cato the Younger. They were anonymous. Now we actually know who the author was, but at the time it was a thing to publish these pamphlets more or less anonymously, and then tell people I was actually the one that wrote them, so that we know who was. But the official signature was Cato the Younger, and that's what gave the inspiration to the Cato Institute, which, as I said, it's a libertarian think tank. So there are definitely influences that from Stoicism in terms of modern politics. Now the question, we have a few minutes left, the question is, so what should be an attitude of a modern Stoic toward politics, right? And I'm not talking about should we endorse this particular position or that particular position, but just the attitude as a Stoic toward politics. Should we participate in the political process? How, what about political discourse, both in person and on social media, or if you have access to it, if you're a writer in your newspapers and magazines, what would be the Stoic attitude, you think, Rob, about politics in the 21st century?
I think there's room to have reasonable disagreement about some of this stuff. I do think, right, that the world of the 20th century United States or Western world or wherever you want to put it, is in some ways more complex and bigger, certainly, than it was in the time of the Roman Empire. Your average group of, however many people we have here today sitting around and talking about this stuff would certainly not have instant access to the latest dispatches from whatever governmental entity like we do today. We all just pick up our phone and we've got the latest tweets or updates from from whatever entities that we might care about, or even that we don't care about.
Right.
Nonetheless, right, I think the answer is pretty clear that we have a duty to participate in our communities. Right. And what that looks like might be very different for different people. One of the texts I think about a lot when I think about duties is the Circles of Heracles. Right.
Yes.
right? The circles of Hierocles tell us that we have a natural inclination, back to the Philippa Foot stuff, right, to want to preserve ourselves and those closest to us, right? But that it's the job of the wise person to sort of expand that circle all the way out to the edges of the cosmopolis, and some have argued even farther, right? In that it's my job, my duty, my role as a citizen of the cosmopolis, right, to extend the same sort of care I do for myself that I do for others. But I'm clearly not capable of taking care of people on the other side of the planet as I am those closest to me. Right. And I have other duties that sort of, impinge on my abilities to do everything I might want to do as a citizen of a cosmopolis. I have duties as a husband, duties as a father, duties as a teacher, right? But nonetheless, all these are duties. How those duties get cashed out, I think, can be very different for different people in different situations, right? Does that mean marching in a protest? Does it mean writing letters to the editor? Does it mean calling your grandmother? Right? It can mean all of those things. And those, so participating in one's family and in one's community, even at a very, you know, on the local parent teacher association board, or, you know, in your state legislature, or running for office yourself, or whatever, these are all ways of participating in politics that we sometimes forget about, I think, or at least it seems to me that we sometimes forget about, that we ought to be doing.
I agree. I think you just reminded me of one or two related points. One about this notion of duties and who do we have duties toward, right? And I agree with your analysis. Yes, I absolutely. So that means, however, that Stoicism, for instance, presents an interesting contrast with, let's say, Confucianism. In Confucianism, also virtue is relational. So we are, in fact, our identity is relational. We are who we are because we relate to other people, you know, family, friends, and so on and so forth. However, in Confucianism, there is a explicit call for, you know, you should give precedence to your family and friends, to the point even of shielding them, for instance, from things that you know. If they do something that is not quite ethical, it's not quite regular, kosher, you should actually shield them because they are your relatives, your family. In Stoicism, the difference is, yes, we do, of course, have a duty to our friends and family, but the precedence that they get is not because they're more important, is, as you just said, because they're closer by. So we are more effective, basically. Our agency is maximized in those cases. But Epictetus specifically talks about in his role ethics about the different kinds of roles that we have, and he says the most fundamental role and the one that trumps everything else is the role of a member of the human cosmopolis.
That's right.
So we should first and foremost do nothing that hurts the human cosmopolis, and then see how we can manage and, you know, handle the other roles. Now, when I say that, occasionally people say, well, but, you know, what am I going to do for the human cosmopolis? I can help my friends and family, but, you know, helping the human cosmopolis seems like a tall order. But reflect for it for a second. Every time we do something that increases, global warming, we are actively harming the human cosmopolis. So one simple way to think about it is not that helping the cosmopolis means I need to be, you know, the president of the United States so that I can actually make a difference on the other side of the world. No, my friend, you can simply abstain from doing, or at least reducing doing things that are in fact damaging to the cosmopolis. And some of those things are actually not that difficult once you start thinking about it in that fashion. Then it remains true, of course, that your agency is maximized locally. Absolutely. Which is why you want to help your friends, your family, your community. You want to be involved. You know, one of the obsessions that I've learned of about Americans is that the only kind of elections that matters is the presidential one. Well, in fact, the most important elections, arguably in the long run, are the local ones, because very few people become politicians unless they actually started down at a local level. And at a local level, you can influence people much more than at a national level. You know, if I send a few bucks to this or that candidate at a national level, then it's not likely to make much of a difference. But if I actually call up or send money to my local representatives here that in Brooklyn, that makes a hell of a lot of a difference, because now we're talking about a few thousand people, not hundreds of millions of people into the arena.
Yeah, I would want to say something even stronger than that, Massimo. Right? And here I think we appeal to our old friend Stoic physics, right? Right. Yeah. To help my neighbor is to help the whole of the cosmopolis. By virtue of the connectedness of the whole of the cosmos, right? So it's not as though there's a difference between helping those locally and acting virtuously locally in any, it's perhaps a difference of degree, but certainly not of kind, between my helping the person right next to me, helping the old lady with her groceries across the street in the classic sort of intro to ethics scenario is helping the cosmopolis. There's no real strong difference there. And so while I agree with what you said, right, I think it's even stronger than that. It's, I don't even have to make these elaborate, well, I don't, maybe it's not elaborate. I don't even have to make these connections between my recycling this week's stuff and global warming for it to be to help the old lady across the street is
right, or volunteer at the soup kitchen or whatever it is, or absolutely. Help your local, you know, things. There's one more question, then we need to probably close. From Denise, it says, how to proceed with people who absolutely will not listen to reason? Well, Marcus explicitly says answers that question, right? He says, when you're talking to people, first of all, try to teach them, you know, words, talk to them, right? Try to bring them to the right side of seeing things, and if that fails, then endure the situation, right? So he says the you have the ability to endure things. You have the ability to be magnanimous and say, okay, I can't reach this person, so I'm still not going to consider him or her my enemy. I am considering a human being who is mistaken about things. And so the attitude, the Stoic attitude toward those people should be one of pity, not one of anger. Right.
Yeah. Either teach them or put up with them.
Exactly. As difficult as sometimes that may be. Now, my friend, we got to the end of the hour. This was a lot of fun. Thanks again for this nice dialogue. So we should remind our listeners, viewers, whatever they are, that the next installment of the Stoanova Conversations is going to be on December 13th, Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. And we'll talk to Eric Weiner, who is the author of The Socrates Express, which is a book that takes a look at a number of different philosophy and philosophers. He actually took a train everywhere and visited a number of places that are pertinent to various philosophies. If you want to register for that event, go to meetup.com and look up the Stoanova. And of course, if you wish to watch past episodes of my conversations with Rob, then just go to Vimeo and search for the Stoanova channel. Other than that, stay safe and have a good rest of the week.
Stay safe, everybody.